This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. One of the most interesting and unconventional forms of school choice doesn't just reject traditional K-12 public and private classrooms, but even homeschooling that uses conventional curricula. The unschooling movement is a radical departure from the conventional wisdom that says kids need structure and direction in order to learn. The term was coined by educational theorist John Holt in the 1970s, and proponents of unschooling even believe that kids are able to teach themselves how to read and do math and should be given as much room to wander and grow as they want. It is a radical notion, even for those of us who believe in robust school choice and those of us who grew up in a world where popular culture, ranging from Pink Floyd's The Wall to movies such as The Breakfast Club, Heathers, and Mean Girls, vilified schools as factories of oppression, conformity, and violence. My guest today is Kerry McDonald. She's a senior education fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education, or FEE, a board member of the Alliance for Self-Directed Education, and the author of the new book, Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. It is a fascinating read, filled with insights both from academic research and her experiences unschooling her own children. We talk about the origins of the unschooling movement, its intellectual underpinnings, and why it's good for parents as well as for kids. Kerry McDonald, thanks for talking to Reason.
So glad to be here, Nick. Thanks.
Okay, so Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. Give me the elevator pitch of your book.
Right, so it's really about disentangling education from schooling and moving from force to freedom in education. So in the book, I look at individuals, families, and organizations that are embracing this idea of self-directed education, mm-hmm. as opposed to coercive schooling models, including versions of school at home homeschooling, right. that are just replicating school at home. And so I also trace sort of the historical and philosophical underpinnings mm-hmm. of our movement toward force in education mm-hmm. and now back to freedom.
Define unschooling versus homeschooling.
Right. So unschooling could be a version of homeschooling. And I do spotlight several families throughout the book who would consider themselves unschooling homeschoolers. And it's really, again, a process of embracing self-directed learning tied to a child's emerging interests and passions that's not really connected strictly to a curriculum the way right, that homeschooling would be.
Yeah, a lot of homeschoolers, as you point out, and this is my experience too, it's the kids are learning either at home or in neighbors' homes or in a non-traditional environment, but they're basically following a curriculum that they might be getting exactly the same thing in their local charter school or private school or public school.
That's right. And I also think it's important to make the distinction, too, that unschooling isn't necessarily anti-curriculum. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's not an imposed curriculum. And I use in the book the definition of Cleveland State University professor Carl Wheatley, who studies unschooling mm-hmm. families and uses this definition of unschooling families are those who use little or no formal adult imposed curriculum. And I think it's an important distinction because I have four children, all of whom are unschooled. And I often use the example of my older daughter, Molly, who I talk about in the book, that she, for example, is very interested in Korean language and culture. And that sprouted from her interest in martial arts. And,
I read that in the book. I was hoping it was from K-pop.
Right.
That'll come later.
Well, martial arts led into all of these other avenues. And so she uses a very formal Korean language curriculum mm-hmm. and meets several times a week with a native Korean language speaker, tutor, and has formal assignments mm-hmm. and evaluations. But it's all driven by her passion.
What are the numbers of unschoolers? Because, you know, it's about, I think, it's like about 6% of K-12 students are homeschooled now or something like that?
It's about 3.5% are mm-hmm. homeschooled.
Okay.
There's
And then maybe 6 or 10% are charter schools or schools of choice that are traditional public schools, something like that.
Yeah. So I think the numbers are typically, we have almost 2 million homeschoolers, which again mm-hmm. would be a catch-all for all kinds
right.
of different variations of homeschooling. It's about, at last count, about 1.8 million homeschoolers, mm-hmm. about 3.5% of the population. I think charter school numbers are more like 5% of
right.
the K-12 population.
Oh, okay. And then private schools are about 10%.
Just under 10%.
Right.
Yes. And I am.
So how many unschoolers?
Right.
Obviously, they're not the people who are going to show up to like be counted either, right?
That's possible. I think homeschooling in general, homeschoolers in general are reticent to be counted.
Right.
And that's some of the challenge if you're looking. These are federal numbers that I'm citing here from the Federal mm-hmm. Department of Education, which are flawed in that way. But it's hard to tell exactly how many homeschoolers would consider themselves unschoolers, partly because, again, they're not necessarily being tracked. But the Department of Education, through their household survey, recently added a question around what approach do you take mm-hmm. through homeschooling? And what they found was that there is a trend toward unschooling or informal mm-hmm. learning practices from 13% of homeschoolers saying they use an informal approach in 2012 to about 20% in 2016.
Okay. So would it be safe to say like 20% of 2 million is a rough, like ballpark upper bound of homeschoolers who are unschoolers?
I think that's right. Yes.
And then you also point out there's a couple of public schools that are unschools.
Well, this,
or were, right?
Yeah. gets into, yeah, there's one fully public non-charter high school called Unschool San Juan in the San Juan Unified School District just outside of Sacramento, California. And they opened just about 2 years ago trying to implement these right. ideas around non-coercive learning and self-directed education. But of course, they're a public school, so they yeah. are still required to map back to core competencies.
Right.
But it's a step in the right direction. A more intriguing story is the other high school that I talk about in the book that was scheduled to open this fall just outside of Boston near where I'm from. Again, a fully public district high school. And they were such a success story. They've been in the works for about 7 years now. They won an $10 million XQ Super School grant mm-hmm. for an innovative high school. They had really everything going for them. And then just this spring, after the book had gone to press, the school committee unanimously decided not to approve their opening for this fall. And I think it just speaks to the problem or the challenge of making these kinds of changes within the compulsory mass schooling system.
Talk or discuss your briefly, you mentioned your four children are unschooled. You do that at home. What led you to that, to following that path?
Yeah. So I was an economics major as an undergraduate, but became increasingly interested in education, particularly this idea of monopoly mass schooling mm-hmm. and these limited choices that I felt like parents could make. And so I took a bunch of education classes, and my senior year of college, I had an opportunity to do a research project on alternative education. And I had a classmate who had a family member who lived nearby who was homeschooling. And I never knew anything about homeschooling. Mm-hmm. I went to K-12 public schools, never knew a homeschooler, never met a homeschooler. This was in the late 1990s. Homeschooling had just become legally recognized in all 50 states just a few years prior by 1993. So it was.
Yeah, it's just as a side note, it's fascinating to think that up until relatively recently, in many places, it was technically illegal to homeschool.
That's right. And many families endured persecution, mm-hmm. challenges around their parental rights, mm-hmm. lots of battles with local school committees. So mm-hmm. modern homeschoolers, I put myself in that category, really have it easy thanks to a lot of yeah. these pioneers. So this was a relatively new phenomenon at the time. And I remember walking into this family's kitchen to shadow them for that semester and being completely enchanted by what I saw, just this authentic learning tied to the child's interests, immersion into the people, places, and things of the community. And it was in stark contrast, really, to that same semester I was doing a student teaching practicum at a local public elementary school. And, it was exactly what we think of an elementary school, a very authoritarian kind of environment, raise your hand for permission to use the bathroom, a set curriculum and evaluations. And I don't think I ever really appreciated that contrast because, of course, I had gone through mm-hmm. that system, as most of us have.
Oh, and so much, I was thinking in preparing for this, so much of our experience, even outside of the classroom, prepares us for that. And, when you listen to albums like Pink Floyd's The Wall, which is, a double album attack on the
Definitely.
British schooling system, Mean Girls, Heathers, Up the Down Staircase, To Sir With Love. I mean, there's this huge, vast kind of cultural production that normalizes on some level how awful schools are, conventional schools are.
That's
you
right.
just take it for granted. You don't even think outside of that system.
I think because it's hard to imagine something that's unlike that, yeah. You know, and I think that was what really was powerful for me in mm-hmm. seeing these really contrasting images and saying there is another way you mm-hmm. can be educated without being schooled. And that's ultimately what led me to graduate school in education policy at Harvard, where I became interested in alternative education and really alternatives to school. This was also a time when the education choice movement was really gaining some ground and mm-hmm. charter schools were starting to expand nationally. So that's where sort of my larger interest in education, freedom, and choice
and
came.
It's fascinating. I mean, as we're gearing up for the meat of the 2020 campaign, presidential campaign and elections, it's a real battleground because so many of the Democratic candidates, including people like Cory Booker, who is very positive towards charter schools and school choice when he was mayor of Newark, has kind of gone missing. And other people like Bernie Sanders are saying we're going to get rid of for-profit charter schools, which virtually don't exist. But everybody understands that the goal from the teachers unions is to minimize school choice as much as possible. And unschooling is like the most radical alternative, right, to conventional, traditional K through 12 education.
I think that's right. Although I would argue that both this idea of kind of being a proponent for charter schools and homeschooling and vouchers and education savings accounts and tax credits and so on are all about giving parents or empowering mm-hmm. parents to be put back in charge of their right. child's education, which of course was the norm up until about the mid-19th century.
Yeah, let's talk about that. One of the things, and I think this for people who may not have kids or their kids have already suffered through school, et cetera, so they might not be that interested in the contemporary moment. One of the most fascinating parts of the book was your history of kind of factory schooling. And it's, again, this is the way power works, right? Where you assume that the world that you inherited is the way it always was and always will be and always should be. Discuss the history of education, of including publicly funded or, you know, education in America from the colonial period through the contemporary time.
Right. So it's really fascinating. I feel like we went from sort of freedom in education to force, and now we're moving back to freedom. So it starts with, really, we can go back as far as the Pilgrims, and they arrived, of course, in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1620. And just a few years later, in the 1640s, they passed the colony's first compulsory education laws. The 1642 law indicated a state interest in an educated citizenry in this mm-hmm. Developing world. And the 1647 law, which was the old deluder Satan law, really compelled towns to provide resources for families that wanted them. So if a town had 50 or more families, they had to hire a teacher. If they had 100 or more families, they had to open and operate a grammar school. It was the town that was compelled by the state to provide these resources, not the parents, to send their children there. And that sense that parents were the ones in charge of their child's education, that they could see to it how their child was educated, was the norm throughout the colonial and revolutionary periods. And of course, it wasn't always the parents teaching the child, although right. home education was certainly the default and where much of the learning took place. There was a wide assortment of private and public schools, charity schools for the poor, church schools, a vibrant apprenticeship experience and expectation in these colonies and throughout the revolutionary period. This all changes in the mid-19th century with the advent of compulsory schooling statutes in, again, Massachusetts leading the way in 1852.
Massachusetts is really the worst state in the country. we all know that. But yeah, and Horace Mann, of course, emerges as one of the great villains of your book. Why did compulsory education happen when it did? And then what was the main problem with that?
Well, there's a few things that were happening. One was that there was dramatic social change happening in the early 19th century, tremendous immigration, and mostly in certainly in Boston, Massachusetts, there was an influx of Irish Catholic immigrants who, of course, challenged the dominant Anglo-Saxon Protestant ethos of the time. This was a lot of change for a culture and a city that, for example, in 1847, 37,000 Irish immigrants came to the city of Boston that only had 100,000 people. Right. The city of Boston doubled in size between 1820 and 1840. So just massive social change. And then this feeling that we need to create institutions to Americanize these Irish Catholic immigrants. Mm. So a lot of it was that. And then Horace Mann traveled to Prussia to look at their education system and was just intrigued by what he saw, this really standardized, centralized, orderly, age-segregated system focused on conformity and compliance. And he, of course, imports that. And
it's fascinating, and you touch on this, of that, you know, it's all about creating a certain type of citizen. It isn't to create great critical thinkers who then will start the next American Revolution. It's kind of people who have the same ideas and a sense of like, okay, I need to fit into this society in a particular way.
Right. It was definitely a system of assimilation, creating these institutions to Americanize these immigrants and a real anti-immigrant ethos around it. And then, you know, these compulsory schooling statutes begin to be passed first in Massachusetts in 1852, which for the first time now compels parents under a legal threat of force to send their child to school. So it's no longer compulsory education. It becomes compulsory schooling. And from that moment forward, really, education and schooling become fused for now over 165 years. And I think hopefully we're at this moment now where we can begin to separate those.
So one of the things that's fascinating to me, because the unschooling movement in particular, I mean, certainly school choice, more broadly is an interesting concept, but unschooling kind of comes into its own in the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of it's in the 1960s. There were earlier experiments and people like John Holt. It's very associated then with a kind of hippie, you know, commune kind of mentality. Where was that coming from? And then what's been going on over the past 20 or 30 years? Because it seems like now it's all over the place, but so much of it is geared around a kind of Christian culture that wants to drop out of mainstream culture. But talk a little bit about the early explicit unschoolers.
Right. So in the book, I actually traced the philosophical underpinnings of unschooling and self-directed education back to the Enlightenment era and to John Locke and this idea of individual liberty and self-determination and human flourishing. You know, John Locke was actually one of the kind of first proponents of gentle parenting. And in his 1693 treatise, Some Thoughts Concerning Education, talks about non-coercive education. He says that children will learn three times as much when they are in tune as they will if they are dragged unwillingly to it. And so he already kind of plants the seeds. But you're right, it's definitely in the 1960s and really the 1970s that the modern homeschooling movement renews, there's sort of this renewed interest in homeschooling and families begin to take their children out of school. So John Holt, who was a well-known author and educator, teacher in private schools in Massachusetts and Colorado, he coins the term unschooling in 1977 in the first newsletter for homeschooling families called Growing Without Schooling. And he defined unschooling as taking children out of school. This is, again, as you mentioned earlier, a time before homeschooling was legally recognized in all states and families were really under a lot of pressure. And he really provided this opportunity for connection among various homeschooling families and also helped to clarify and loosen compulsory schooling statutes to enable parents to pull their children from school for homeschooling. And so he was really the one who kind of led the charge. And his process really evolved from some of the earlier thinkers like Paul Goodman in the early 1960s, A.S. Neill, who founded the Summerhill School, which was the first real self-directed school in England, founded in 1921 and still in existence today. And then, of course, Ivan Illich, whose book Deschooling Society came on the scene in 1970. And it was Illich who really was the one who motivated Holt to realize that these changes couldn't happen in schools. Holt, up until that time, had still been a teacher. He wrote How Children Fail and How Children Learn, which were best-selling books. But he still thought that this could be reformed within the schools.
Yeah, it's, your book, and I found it really fascinating. And it's so radical that, you know, it's kind of like Montessori schools, you know, are almost like prisons. Compared to where you're ending up. And it's very funny because I feel like only in a certain part of the kind of reason universe libertarian world where you'd be like, you know, the Montessori schools are a little bit too rigid.
Well, I think Montessori is probably the closest thing to this idea of unschooling and self-directed education. But I do have a family that I spotlight. And of course, in the book, I spotlight all kinds of families, individuals, organizations, and unschooling alumni who've gone through this approach to learning. But there is a family who was in who had their child in a Montessori school and did find that even that had some, curriculum expectations and requirements that were too stifling.
So you also talk about people like John Dewey and Rousseau. I guess what I'm getting at is a lot of school reform, a lot of education reform towards the idea of the student being in charge of learning seem to emerge from what's considered the left. And I realize in certain instances, we're talking anachronistically because like obviously John Locke is one of the first great liberals, but it, you know, what he's talking about doesn't map directly onto where we are now and things like that. How did unschooling kind of move from the left to, is it a libertarian place? Is it a Christian place? Is it a, you know, what's going on with that?
Well, first, I would just say that I do mention, you know, Rousseau and Dewey, but I make the case that there was a real shift in the early 20th century from the followers of John Dewey and progressive education and the followers of A.S. Neal and Paul Goodman.
And Dewey is a minor villain in your book, right?
Because that's right.
He ultimately, as liberating as in many ways he seemed to be, I mean, he's very regimented.
Right. I mean, there's still this expectation that these are the things that you will learn. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of let's create the environment that enables you to learn these things that we've decided you will learn. And there's definitely the focus on the teacher as the central figure.
Right.
Whereas with unschooling and self-directed education, it's the individual. And of course, I think that's where the libertarian philosophy comes in as well. And I think now, you know, it's really a hodgepodge. If you look at who's embraced unschooling and self-directed education, it really runs the gamut from, you know, definitely still kind of your hippie liberals that launched the modern homeschooling movement in the 1970s. And then also, of course, was grown by the conservative Christians. There are, you know, Christian unschoolers and kind of classical unschoolers who will focus on incorporating these ideas, but still being true to their own faith and beliefs.
I want to ask you about this and reference your experience with your own kids of this. You have a couple of chapters where, and I forget who said it, that you're not taught to read. You learn, you teach yourself to read, or you learn how to read or something. But like you talk about how kids will learn how to read and do math on their own, given the right circumstances. And that blew my mind because like, and although even as you talk about your own experiences, and I think everybody has this kind of thing of where like, it was really hard to understand math for some of us or to learn how to read in a conventional context. So I don't know why it surprises me that if somebody wasn't hectoring me all the time, I might actually find math more interesting and get better at it. But discuss that about, you know, of
sure.
this way where kids are teaching themselves how to read and do math.
Sure. So there's so much to talk about there. But there's, you know, first this idea that when children are surrounded by resources and opportunities and supportive adults, they are little learning machines. They love to learn. They're curious and they're creative. And that these are sort of natural human drives that we erode through our system of forced schooling. And so the idea with unschooling is just don't erode those. Don't create those conditions of force that begin to really limit a child's creativity and curiosity. But I'll cite a couple of examples that I talk about in the book. The first is the work of Sugata Mitra, who did the 2013 award-winning TED Talk, and he's a professor at Newcastle University who's written extensively and published numerous academic articles about his hole-in-the-wall experiments of taking young children in the slums of New Delhi, placing internet-enabled computer on the wall in a safe public space and seeing these children teach themselves English and teach themselves bioengineering and do all of these remarkable things by given access to resources and opportunities. And he goes on to do, you know, advanced studies to see how this is possible and what he calls the school in the cloud. And so there's an example of, you know, how this kind of approach to learning really works. And then in the math example, I talk a lot about various kinds of organizations that are incorporated unschooling. So it's not just a version of family-centered homeschooling, but it's also unschooling. And one of those models is the Sudbury model of schooling. And Dan Greenberg was the one who created the Sudbury Valley School in the 1960s as, again, I think part of this alternative education movement. That school just celebrated its 50th year anniversary in Framingham, Massachusetts. And he's written extensively on his Sudbury model. And one of the things that he talks about is that he found that if you look at how long it takes kids to learn math, to learn the entire elementary school math curriculum, when they're ready and eager and it's interesting to them, it's 20 hours. And so, and I think, you know, that's sort of a story that's echoed throughout my book and certainly other books too, that this idea that you have to kind of go through this hours and hours of painstaking process of learning math is simply untrue, that you're, when you're ready and willing and eager, it's a relatively straightforward and simple process.
So, to go back to something we touched on a little bit, is there an inherent libertarian logic to unschooling?
Well, I think it's this idea of freedom from coercion, individual self-determination, and human flourishing, that we want to give children as much freedom as possible and avoid force. And sort of this idea that, you know, if we want children to grow up in a free society, how can we expect them to do that when they spend their childhood under an authoritarian system of forced schooling?
I mean, it's a perfectly obvious connection to make or inference to draw. One of the big challenges I see or hear when people start talking about unschooling or letting the kid decide that, you know, what they want to study is like, well, then they won't learn all the things they need to learn. What's your quick response to that?
Well, I have two responses quickly. One is, you know, we all have gaps in our learning, and there's no way we could possibly learn and know everything. There's also a difference, I think, between...
But I mean, you definitely know, or at some point, if you grew up in Massachusetts, you know all of the counties in Massachusetts. It's very important for everybody to know all the counties in their home state and things like that.
Right. There's definitely gaps, I think, in the learning of all of us.
Yeah.
But with unschooling, I think there's this sense that also this isn't just a free for all. And one of the things that I really, one of the major themes in the Unschooled book is this idea of freedom balanced by responsibility. And there's a term that A.S. Neal uses in his book, Summer Hill, where he talked about the school that he founded. And he actually wrote another book with this title, Freedom Not License. So freedom without responsibility turns into license, where my freedom could negatively impact your freedom. And so I spent a lot of time looking at how these individuals, families, and organizations negotiate freedom balanced with responsibility. So this isn't a free-for-all. It's not sort of kind of the Lord of the Flies.
Is this a class-bound phenomenon, though? Is this only something for well-educated, you know, the parents who put it in place, you know, for well-educated, well-off parents? Is there a class analysis here that needs to be taken into account?
Well, I mentioned earlier the research of Sugata Mitra. Of course, he's showing that all, children of all classes are able to learn this way. So this certainly isn't unique to more privileged children in terms of their capacity to learn and curiosity.
But
creativity,
as a sociological phenomenon.
But as a practical matter, I think, you know, what we find is that there's a lot of schools that these self-directed learning organizations that I spotlight who go above and beyond to try to make sure that their tuition is extremely affordable and really have a real ambition to recruit and invite into their programs.
Do you need a stay-at-home parent, though?
Well, and that's where I talk about these self-directed learning centers, which I think are really expanding the unschooling approach to more families, where you can attend up to 5 days a week at many of these learning centers, so that homeschooling really becomes the legal mechanism to take back control of your child's education, free your child from compulsory schooling. But then you as the parent decide when and how and where that child should be educated, again, similar to the way it was prior to the 19th century. And these self-directed learning centers, again, which really try to be much more financially accessible to many more families, are helping to expand this option.
What are the biggest obstacles to the growth or acceptance of the unschooling movement? And are you optimistic, you know, that 10 years down the road, it will be bigger and better and more influential?
I am optimistic. I mean, I think the obstacles are this, the idea that, you know, many of us can't imagine a different way of learning. We cannot imagine being educated without being schooled because we've been through this system. But I'm hopeful because I think that technology really now shows us as adults how we can kind of reconnect with our self-directed education drives. And so, you know, whether it's figuring out how to fix the toilet by using a YouTube video, or if you want to learn to play the guitar, you can connect with, you know, instructors online now. I think we're already seeing the capacity of technology to drive self-directed education. It used to be that you went to school because that was where the knowledge was. Right. That was where the books were and the teachers were. Well, now we have so much more information at our fingertips. And I think that once we start to see this in our own lives, the ability to use self-directed education in our own lives, we'll want to really give that gift to our children.
That's really fascinating. And that's kind of a cultural explanation. And it that might also push back against the tiger mom ethos, right? Of where it's like, especially if you're, you know, coming from a, you know, middle class, upper middle class educated background where, you know, you have to have your kid playing the piano by three if they're going to get into the right place at five, et cetera. You're kind of, that makes a counter argument to that. Are there political or, you know, kind of power-based structures? I mean, like, are teachers unions, is the vast, you know, education industrial complex, do things have to change there? And how does that happen?
Well, I think that's where I like to put a discussion around unschooling and frame it within the larger education choice movement and the focus around parental choice in education. Because, you know, I certainly love this philosophy, and I think that we should move from force to freedom in education. But I don't want to tell everybody to do that, right? Because then that would just be adding the same kind of force. I think what we need to do is just create a lot of different educational options and opportunities for all kinds of families and let parents decide what's the right fit for their children and for their family.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Carrie McDonald. She's the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. Carrie, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
This has been The Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.